Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today, my conversation with Richard Crockett, an emeritus professor in the School of American Studies at the University of East Anglia. His book, Einstein and 20th Century Politics, A Salutary Moral Influence, published by Oxford University Press, is an intellectual biography of Einstein's political thought. As one of the most compelling figures of the 20th century, Einstein first gained public attention for his scientific theories, placing him on the world stage. Developing a broad network of liberal internationalists, he had the opportunity to speak for and support some of the most critical issues of his day. Crockett follows him through his early days and his connections with men like Bertrand Russell, G.H. Wells, and Abel Schweitzer that shaped his political thought as a global public intellectual. From his intellectual influence and personal charm, he worked on behalf of pacifism, Zionism, world government, freedom, and against the arms race. Einstein's political ideas emerged from a deep moral conviction, yet his thought remains complex, non-dogmatic, and at times seemingly contradictory. Crockett has captured a deep moral sensibility and an agile political mind of a scientist who exercised a salutary moral influence. Here's my conversation with Richard Crockett.
Now let me introduce you to the author, Richard Crockett. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. You have written a fascinating book about a fascinating mind. But before we get into the book, tell us a little about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Einstein and 20th Century Politics.
Okay, my background is as an academic historian in the field of American foreign policy and international relations, and I was particularly interested in the Cold War. I then happened to find myself spending several months a year in Jerusalem. My wife was working there, and I saw a sign one day while I was crossing the campus of the Hebrew University saying Einstein Archive, and I thought to myself, oh, well, that sounds interesting. I'd been interested in the atomic bomb, and I thought I'd look at one or two documents that he was associated with. And I went in, I got looking at the archive, and it started with just looking at two or three documents, and it mushroomed into a large project. That's broadly how it started, as an element of chance. Also, I was just retired, looking for a project, and I was in the fortunate position of being able to choose a project with no gun at my head for publication, and it was extremely pleasurable, and it took me 5 years.
Okay, let's talk about Einstein. How did Einstein, which most people know as a scientist, how did he develop a political voice on so many issues?
Well, you could say that he was a political person with a small p, that is not an official party sense, from quite a young age. He was very, you could say, anti-militarist from a childhood. Apparently, he was standing with his mother once watching a parade of soldiers, and his mother said, no, you might be like those one day. And he said, no, I'll never be like those sad-looking people. So he had attitudes which were potentially political from a young age. Then when he was in his teens, he found himself in Switzerland, the complicated reasons why he had left Germany, partly because he didn't want to join the army. But he found himself lodging with an individual, a professor who was very political, encouraged discussion of free discussion at table and evening dinner and so on. And Einstein took advantage of this and remembered him for the rest of his life as a very formative influence. And then as he was a student, he engaged in discussion groups with people. He was not active politically in a party sense, but he was extremely aware of what was going on. And he was particularly close to a man called Adler, who was the son of the Austrian Social Democratic Party leader. And that, again, brought him into contact with, if you like, real politicos and lots of discussion. So he showed an interest from an early age without getting involved in party issues or towing a particular line.
You describe him as a liberal internationalist.
Yes.
And his circle, his intellectual circle, he had a very wide intellectual circle. These were global connections with yes. other liberal internationalism. Can you talk about who they were and what was their aim?
Okay. Liberal internationalism, I suppose, is a reaction to the kind of nationalism which produced the First World War. And I should preface this by saying that his first public political activity was standing out in opposition to the First World War. That was crucial. And he was very much in a minority among his colleagues at the University of Berlin and other institutions there. But that got him on the road. He was naturally non-national and believed citizenship was a kind of business arrangement. He didn't have this afflatus about the idea of the nation. Liberal internationalism really, in the sense that he was involved in it, was a product of the First World War, and that idea, never again, you know, let's produce institutions that will prevent war from happening again. And that produced the League of Nations and a whole succession of other institutions. And in the course of being involved in that and in follow-up campaigns against war and for peace, he came into contact with, among others, Albert Schweitzer, Bertrand Russell, Gandhi, John Dewey, the American philosopher, Romain Rolland. In fact, the first one he engaged with, Romain Rolland, the French writer and intellectual, who was also a fervent opponent of the First World War, and also H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw, who you might think, wow, that's a strange set of connections. But they were also both very political, very global, and very involved in all these issues of war and peace and trying to deal with the post-First World War situation.
Now, this intellectual circle that he was engaged in, their aim was to persuade or be actively involved in the political arena? How do they see themselves, and how did he see himself in that?
That's a very good and a very tricky question, because it's not the case that he simply thought, I will stand up and make a speech or sign a petition and policy will change. He aimed, I think, and they aimed, to engage in the debate and create a climate of opinion in which liberal internationalist opinions would be pervasive, or at least would have some influence on the public debate. But he did also have a further, if you like, his most advanced position, which never came to fruition, but he had this idea of a kind of core of wise men, and it was men I think he was thinking of, who could provide what he called a salutary moral influence, and heilsamen moralischen Einfluss on international affairs by, in the most advanced form that he pursued this, that this would be a kind of almost like a jury which would be who would listen to arguments and come out with the best possible answer and advise governments. That was ultimately the idea. It never came to fruition, but he, in a letter to Freud, from which I just quoted, he did propose this. He said, let's get the best minds of our generation together and try and influence governments in the direction of sane policies. Nothing like that ever happened. I suppose the think tank is the most is the closest thing. But he was notoriously unwilling to get involved in too much bureaucracy. So on the one hand, he had this idea that you could have a group of wise men advising governments. On the other hand, he was rather too much of an individualist to get involved in that kind of thing.
Now, what's interesting about your book, that you show a man who has an amazing intellect, able to think in a non-dogmatic way about everything, and amounts of flexibility, intellectual flexibility. How did his personality. He had a very kind of quirky personality. Mm. At one time, yeah. Sometimes charming, sometimes a little brash. So can you talk about his personality, his temperament, and how that kind of went with his intellectual bent?
Well, I suppose I would say that his most salient quality was curiosity about people, about ideas, about theories, about the world. And it gave him an immense... It engaged him in a whole array of different questions. He was unable to stop thinking about questions, if you like. And I think if I've put my finger, I hope, on something that other people haven't in relation to his politics, it's that so many people wanted to claim him for their own. The Zionists, the pacifists, the world government people. And he did support all these causes, but on his own terms, in his own way, with certain limitations and qualifications. And I think that is a crucial thing. He had an instinctive understanding that if you take one good idea to its logical conclusion, you produce fanaticism. And he resisted that always. He, as you rightly say, he was very flexible in his thinking without being flabby. He hated compromises. This is what I found myself getting tied up in his contradictions, if you like, that on the one hand, he's very flexible. On the other one, he has a very clear moral stance on things, yet he was never fanatical. And I think that is what saved him from being a bore, among other things.
Well, one of the things we're going to do before we get into his political thought, I want to talk about why you have written about Einstein. It seems to me like he would be a figure that, like, there'd be reams and reams and reams of books written about him and papers and debates and probably conferences and probably there's probably some sort of society out there, the Einstein Society. If there is one, there probably is one. So there's a lot probably has been paid attention to him already. So why another book about Einstein?
Okay, well, I'm going to preface this by saying that I made the great, and some people would say a great mistake. My first book was a general history of the Cold War, and people said to me, why write about that? You know, people have written loads about the Cold War. Actually, mine was the first post-Cold War history of the Cold War. But the reason, the first answer to your question is, I am attracted to the big questions which have been addressed a lot in the past, and you try to bring some new perspective to it. That's the first answer to the question. The second is, very curiously, although there are hundreds of books on Einstein, I mean on his non-scientific side as well as the scientific side, there is no single volume that addressed his whole political activity as a whole, except a couple of edited volumes, which I mentioned early on in my book, but which are source books rather than analyses as such. And so it was the challenge of putting together a lot of stuff that hadn't been put together and looking at him as a whole, rather than as a man of different causes.
Okay, one of the things, what you're saying basically in your book, that pacifists have used him for his pacifist positions.
Yes.
But you're looking at, or internationalism, or world government, or all the different things, Zionism, but you're trying to look at it as a whole. So let's talk about Einstein's political thought. One of the things that you mentioned is Einstein paradox.
Yes.
What is the Einstein paradox in his political thought?
Well, to me, the paradox actually relates to the relationship between his scientific thought and his political thought. And I was very struck by the fact that in science, he was an endless questioner, and he looked at, I'm quoting here, he looked at every side of the question from upside, from the downside, from the side, etc. In politics, he tended to think that there were no good ideas, just obvious ideas, which and all the issue was to put it into practice. That's what he said. He seemed to me to have a way of thinking about politics which was in some respect different from his way of thinking about science. So it seems to me you have, in a sense, two Einsteins. One is a totally integrated figure who is, I mean, is if you see in his speeches or you listen to his speeches and you read his writings, he is wonderfully integrated. He's like a man without deep, dark patches in his brain that you think might come up and bite him sometime. On the other hand, he seems like almost a split personality. With science, he does science with one side and politics with the other. He was always asked, what difference does your theory of relativity make to the way we think about the world outside science? He said, none at all. I find that very odd, because most scientific theories do have applications, and people naturally want to make them apply, as they did with Darwinism, with Newtonianism, with any number of biological and other theories. But he resisted that idea very strongly. I don't pretend to be able to understand totally why that was the case.
One thing that you talk about is that he was a very intuitive thinker. And he was very intuitive both. This is what was similar, was that in his scientific work, he did follow his intuition to try to get to the answer. And
he did.
And in politics, he also had this kind of gut level, maybe call it a moral intuition, about he knew what was right and what was to be done.
Yes. The difference is that with the politics, he, as it were, stopped with the intuition. He didn't become fanatical, but he didn't apply the same kind of analytical rigor to politics as he applied to science. And I spent some time in the book talking about his exchanges with Freud about the theme of war. They had this big public exchange of letters. They were invited by the League of Nations to do this. And it struck me that in this exchange, Freud was the scientist and Einstein was something else. He didn't apply his scientific criteria to this issue. I think because he thought it so well, war is bad. Why debate? There are no other issues. Whereas Freud actually raised the question. He said, well, why do you think war is necessarily wrong? You know, it's been in the human race for thousands of years. Shouldn't we just analyze it as something that exists, not as a moral question?
Right.
Now, for Einstein, it was always a moral question.
So let's talk about his pacifism that you just brought it up. He was very flexible in his pacifism. He wasn't an absolutist. There were times when he kind of said, oh, well, maybe this is a controlled exception. Can you talk about his pacifism?
Well, yes. I think from 1914, when he signed a petition against the First World War, until 1931 or so, 1931-2, he did describe himself as a militant pacifist. He didn't use the word absolute, but a militant pacifist. And he was associated with all the most advanced pacifists in the internationally, not just nationally. But when Hitler came to power, he changed his tune and he engaged in a qualified form of pacifism. For example, in response to a letter from a French pacifist who was living in Belgium, who asked him, should I submit to join the army, you know, be conscripted into the army? I'm against war and you are, of course, advise me. And he assumed Einstein would say, no, of course, resist. But by this time, that is when on the threshold of Hitler coming to power, Einstein said, no, any person now must be prepared to fight Hitler. And he said this very early, you know, actually 1932, 1933. And therefore, his pacifism became qualified, as was the case of many other people, by the fact that the greater danger was Hitler. Hitler was greater than the abstract danger of war, or the principle of war itself. And so he lost a lot of friends, a lot of credibility among pacifists and so on then, but he never wavered in that. He still called himself a pacifist, and he believed that world government should be instituted to bring it about. But on the specific question, he said, you must be prepared to fight Hitler.
Part of his anti-war, his pacifism, was also related to his real sort of almost hatred of nationalism, and any nationalism was a source of war. As you know, in Germany, that was a source of war, was German nationalism. So it kind of goes together.
Consider that he was born in 1879 in Germany, only 8 years after the unification, the war of unification against France. Germany was very a militaristic society, not just in the sense that it had great emphasis on military prowess, but its educational system was rather militarized and disciplined, heavily disciplined. And Einstein was just temperamentally not suited to that. He resisted it at school. And as I said, he resisted being drawn into the army. And at the age of 16, emigrated to Switzerland. His family had gone to Italy, and Einstein ended up going to Switzerland for the rest of his education. But yes, you're right. He was instinctively anti-national in the sense that he didn't believe in, he certainly wouldn't believe that you should lay down your life for a nation for a nation which showed any sort of aggressive force against other nations. And that stayed with him forever. He actually became a Swiss citizen and then an American citizen and also a German citizen. But the one that he liked most was the Swiss, because they were less militaristic and less nationalistic than any other nationality that he was a member of.
Now, then there's this sort of contradiction in that he supported Zionism, but it was I understand that it was sort of, you know, couched in a sort of a cultural Zionism versus a state based Zionism. Yeah. Can you talk about first his Jewish heritage, how he related to his Jewish heritage, or did he, and why did he embrace some form of Zionism?
His Jewish heritage is interesting because it's the case that he was always aware of it, but until really the First World War, he didn't make much of it. It wasn't a great obstacle to his progression in his profession. He went to a Catholic school when he was young. He was the only Jew in the class, and there were jibes, and there was an element of anti-Semitism in this, but it never proved a damaging break on his advancement or his career. What really stimulated his sense of his Jewishness was the end of the First World War. When the end in Germany, the end of the First World War was a disaster. You know, they lost the war, and the story was that they'd been stabbed in the back, that they'd made they'd surrendered before they needed to, and for various reasons, the Jews were accused of being supporters of the stab in the back, of having stabbed Germany in the back. At the same time, there was a huge influx of Jewish refugees from Eastern Europe, especially from Russia, and into this melee, the Jewish question became massive in Germany and Europe generally. And it was at that point that his consciousness became political, and he joined and supported Zionist ideas, that is, of a homeland in the Middle East. But as you say, he was resistant to the idea right up to the point where the State of Israel was founded in 1948. He was resistant to the idea of a Jewish political state. He believed there should be a homeland, but he not at the expense of Arab inhabitants of that area. When Israel was formed, he reluctantly supported the State of Israel. In fact, he was offered the presidency of the State of Israel in 1952, amazingly, after the death of its first president, Chaim Weizmann. And he rejected it for a number of reasons. And it said that David Ben-Gurion, who was the prime minister at the time, was delighted because he knew that Einstein would be a very difficult person to deal with. Einstein himself, I think, intuitively, he was very old by this time, but also he intuitively knew that to toe a political line, particularly in relation to Israel, would have been very difficult for him.
Now, the thing about, when I noticed in that chapter where you talk about Zionism, is that he was often dragged into Zionist issues that he was reluctant to be involved in, and he would try to extract himself from it, but didn't want to extract himself. He was he had a lot of conflicted feelings about Zionism and his relationship to it.
He certainly did. And I think, I have to say, as someone, as a non-Jew who has spent a lot of time in Israel because I married into Jewish family, and that chapter is the longest chapter in the book. I found that the most interesting, the most challenging, and the most absorbing chapter, in a way, to write. And you're absolutely right. He was... he didn't believe in a similar... He arrived at Zionism almost by default because he didn't believe in the idea of assimilation, that German Jews could kind of disappear into the woodwork. There was a strong assimilationist feeling among German Jews in the 19th century and right through into the 20th century. He said, look, he had a close friend, Fritz Haber, the chemist, who said, look, I'm Jewish, but I'm a German first. Why make all this fuss about Zionism, draw attention to ourselves, make things difficult for ourselves? We're Germans first. And Einstein's answer always was, well, they won't let you be just Germans. You're always Jews to them. We must embrace it and take it forward and promote the interests of Jews as Jews. We have no choice. That was his view. And in this great debate between assimilationists and Zion, that's, I think, ultimately why he ended up in the arms of the Zionists, or he embraced Zionism.
Which makes me wonder, I'm going to ask you a question. You talked about these two sort of schools of thought about being Jewish, and I'm wondering if he represented really more of the middle that a lot of Jewish people in the West probably felt like him. They wanted to stay in their countries wherever they were.
Yeah.
They didn't want to go to Palestine and be part of a Jewish state, but they were supporters of Zionism for other reasons besides their desire to go live in Palestine.
Yes, that's correct. And of course, he resisted moving to Palestine and was invited many times, or it was assumed that he should go and for example, take a prominent role in the Hebrew University, which was founded partly under his aegis and with his fundraising efforts and so on in 1923. I think you're right. He represented a position that a lot of Jews could identify with, who were not violently pro-Zionist in the sense of wanting a state. I call him, a Zionist by association, as compared with Weizmann, who I called a Zionist by identification. And I think that represents reasonably his position. And he was a secular individual. I mean, we could perhaps talk about his ideas about religion, but he wasn't a practicing Jew. And so he represented a situation which many Jewish people found themselves, who were secular, non-Zionist, or at least non-politically Zionist Jews.
Yeah, but they tend to identify, I think you called him a cultural Zionism.
Yes, they call that cultural Zionism, which is to say a recognition that Jewish culture is something different, something special, something which a large group of people identify with, but he didn't see that as necessarily entailing a political organization of the state, which he saw as producing a kind of nationalism which was might tend to be destructive. I should say one last thing at the end about this. Well, that's some more to say, but many people have wanted to claim him for either Zionism or anti-Zionism, and they found it very difficult. Each side can draw on different quotations and find things that will suit them. But the most interesting moment, I think, comes right at the end of his life, where a lady journalist came to his house, and they talked about things. And towards the end, he said, well, you know, we all thought Israel was going to be something special. It's turned out to be just another country, you know, nationalist and so on. And this was published, and he was absolutely furious and said, you should not take a private conversation and publish it and so on. And my take on that is that that probably did represent his private view, but he didn't want to be seen publicly to be undermining the state of Israel. And that was his position. He was trying to balance a lot of things.
Okay, now, the burden that he carried, I think, since he did his scientific theories, was that he was associated with the bomb in the popular imagination. And this was, I think, probably just painful to him, that he was somehow the man, you know, the genius behind the bomb.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about his actual involvement with the development of the bomb, if there was any, and what did he do? Let's ask you that question first. What was his association with the bomb?
Okay, well, there are two avenues down which you can take this argument. First of all, is the theory itself. E equals mc squared. It simply expresses the amount of energy which is locked up in every atom all around us. And the unlocking of that energy is what ultimately led to the atomic bomb. But he produced E equals mc squared in a paper written in 1905. The atomic bomb project, Manhattan Project, wasn't started until 1942. There's a huge distance to run between that very theoretical statement about relationship between mass and energy and the producing of a bomb. So, but in people's minds, somehow E equals MC squared equals the atomic bomb. So that's one reason why the association is made. The second reason people make the association is that in 1939, he signed and partly drafted and signed a very important letter to Franklin Roosevelt. It was actually at the behest of another scientist called Leo Szilard, a Hungarian, but who recognized that Einstein's help would be enormously favorable in convincing Franklin Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, of the dangers of nuclear fission, of the possibility of nuclear fission, and the possibility that Germany might get nuclear fission and therefore use it in the war. And that was the burden of the letter. Nuclear fission had just been discovered, and the theoretical possibility of a bomb based on nuclear fission, that is the splitting of the atom, was there. And Szilard thought we could, with Einstein's help, we could then warn the American government that this was taking place. Among other things, a lot of uranium was disappearing, or the Germans were taking over Czechoslovakia and had taken over Czechoslovakia and were mining a lot of uranium, which is one of the basic ingredients. So that's the second reason. This famous letter, the letter to Roosevelt in September 1939. And actually, that was really the only substantial element of contact that he had with the Manhattan Project. There were a couple of other follow-up letters, but he wasn't involved in the project. And to his irritation and anger right through the post-war period, this kept coming up, and he kept trying to resist it. And for obvious reasons, because it went against. Here you have Einstein, the great pacifist, who's the father of the H-bomb. You know, it's it makes this very embarrassing, difficult for him.
So, but he did get involved then in trying to stop the spread of nuclear arms.
Yes, I think his major institutional role after the war was with an organization called ECAS, or the Emergency Congress of American Scientists, which sought to advocate international control of nuclear, not just nuclear weapons, but nuclear energy. And this was a program or a proposal that came to the UN in 1946 and was debated through 1946, 47, 48, and finally came to nothing. But Einstein was continuously involved in this. In fact, he headed that organization. Later, he opposed the production of the H-bomb, that is the hydrogen bomb, which is produced by nuclear fusion rather than fission. And he later then also was a signatory of the so-called Einstein or Russell Einstein Manifesto in the year he died, which proposed a general halt to the whole nuclear arms race. That in turn led to the beginnings of the so-called Pugwash conferences and a whole lot of institutions of anti-nuclear institutions in throughout the Cold War period. He had an enormous influence in this area, therefore, in being involved in these early efforts to control and then to abolish nuclear weapons.
Now, he came to a place where he believed that you had to go beyond internationalism in order to control war, nuclear arms. Mm. And he was an advocate of world government along with some of his colleagues. Can you talk about what was the idea of world government and who was he involved with? What other people was he in dialogue with about world government, and how do they think that was going to work out?
Yes, well, world government came onto the agenda, I suppose, after the First World War, but with a vengeance after the Second World War, because, again, I mentioned this never again mentality. The idea, how do you stop these mega wars happening, is by instituting a government of the world which can, I suppose, control the both the arms and the kind of conflicts which lead to war. Having said that, when you ask who was advocating world government, well, for a short period of time in 1945, 1946, nearly everybody on the liberal side of things was advocating world government. It seemed the obvious thing. Even Dorothy Thompson, the journalist, was advocating, and she was a more of a didn't generally talk about international affairs like this. He was very influenced by or struck by the writings of a Hungarian emigre called Emery Reeves, who wrote a book in 1945 on world government and the necessity for world government. But there were a whole lot of people, as I say, for a short period of time, it was the going thing. Very soon, of course, as the Cold War got going, people began to say, this is a pipe dream. World government in the situation where the Soviet Union is our great enemy, not possible. Einstein, though, continued to believe it. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that world government is not so simple. You know, how do you institute it? What is it? How much sovereignty do countries surrender? Einstein actually had this idea that they would surrender only their war-making power. Now, I discuss in the book some, that this to me is a slightly artificial and pie-in-the-sky idea, because actually, as we're seeing with Mr. Trump, national security issues are the primary function of nations. So if you surrender that, you're surrendering everything. But the reason I mention this is that people have assumed that world government is one thing and that Einstein was an out-and-out world governmenter. But actually, if you look at him alongside Emery Reeves, and I think I'm the first to point this out, he had a very qualified notion of world government because he didn't want to outlaw the kind of positive, if you like, positive nationalism which issued in independence for colonial powers. For example, Emery Reeves apparently would be happy for the British Empire to continue and was very critical of ideas of Indian independence and so on, which came in 1947, and then subsequently all the African countries in the 50s. Einstein wanted to leave room for a kind of nationalism and a sovereignty that was a positive one. It's not clear how this works out institutionally or in practice, but he wanted to keep that option open. So he wasn't an absolutist in this or in any other field.
Because he wanted to maintain the self-determination of peoples, of people groups like the Indian people, but to give up their war powers. The problem with that, of course, is just about everything is attached to war, economics.
Yeah.
I mean, you can really get into that. But so let's talk about how he saw individual freedom of the individual within the context of world government. And what was his notion of individual freedom within the nation state, within world government? What does it look like? What is freedom for him?
Well, I'm going to surprise you again by saying that there's a deep contradiction in his ideas about freedom. I say surprise in it with a somewhat ironic tone. He believed that individuals needed freedom in their lives, and he talked about external freedom and internal freedom. External freedom is enough goods and chattels to stay alive and be comfortable. Internal freedom is about the soul, is about freedom of ideas, freedom of speech, freedom of this and that, and all the other things we're familiar with. But he also had an idea of a fairly rigidly deterministic idea, which came from his idea of physics, his notion of science, that actually everything was determined. He had an ultimately deterministic view of the world. And it was for this reason, for example, that he totally rejected a large part of the theory of quantum mechanics, which was the theory, if you like, that succeeded his own theories. He rejected it because of its idea of indeterminacy, of chance, of statistical happenings rather than, as he believed, deterministic physical laws. So we have, again, a somewhat a contradiction. He believes in freedom for the individual. He certainly cultivated and projected a sense of individual freedom as almost nobody else did. Meanwhile, within this framework of a deterministic science or a theory, scientific theory of determinism.
What is his relationship with socialism?
Well, he very often called himself a socialist, and he wrote a couple of essays about socialism, which one of which wasn't published in his lifetime, but one of which was. I think, and from an early age, he'd been associated, as I mentioned, with Adler, the son of the Austrian SDP leader, and Social Democratic leader. But he tended to, he on the one hand seemed to embrace socialism. On the other hand, he didn't accept all its class implications, the idea of class conflict, or a Marxist concept of socialism, which saw history as historically the society divided into classes and the class conflict was the fundamental feature. He was a socialist in that he disliked inequality. He was a socialist in that he believed that the community should be was equally important as the individual. And he was a socialist in that he believed that the basic economic resources should be run by the state. But he fell short of pure socialism by retaining a very strong element of individualism. And the way I describe it in the book is that in his essay, most famous essay on socialism, it's only towards the end of the essay he gets around to economics. You know, most socialists see the economic factor as being prime. He didn't. He didn't know much about economics, to be honest. And he didn't see it as prime. And you can balance his commitment to socialism with equally strong commitments to individualism and the idea of the special individual who has certain special insights. It's quite a complicated story. He was an egalitarian, and certainly in his personal life, he was wonderfully egalitarian. He could talk to anybody. And if that's socialism, then he was a socialist.
Now, during the Cold War, he was considered un-American during the Cold War for several things. World government, his support of stopping the arms race, which the Cold War thought it was so important to protect American interest. The entrenchment of nationalism. There's a lot of reasons. So I'm sure he didn't like the United States as a state any more than he liked Russia as a state. Mm-hmm. So how did it? Let's talk about what were the political ramifications to him personally of being labeled sort of un-American during the Cold War?
Yes, I would want to say that, to preface this by saying that he was regarded as dangerously subversive at the moment he arrived in the United States, and particularly the Daughters of the American Revolution and other organizations as early as 1933, 1934 felt that they had a dangerous radical on their hands because he came with a reputation of being a pacifist, of making statements on social issues like about marriage and so on, which were regarded as dangerous. So he had a reputation to begin with. But you're right, the Cold War is when it really comes to matter. I should say also that during the 30s, he went to the White House. He was a great friend of Roosevelt's. He liked the Roosevelt's a lot and went to dinner with Roosevelt. So, again, there's this kind of odd contradiction in him. But in the Cold War, yes, he was regarded as being particularly, in the wartime itself too, as being subversive to the extent that not being allowed to work on the Manhattan Project. I mean, that was one reason why he didn't work for the Manhattan Project, because he was regarded as a security risk. Even people who didn't believe he was outright subversive thought he was unreliable, you know, that he might say something that was unscripted or difficult, you know. But the key thing in the Cold War is that the FBI, and particularly J. Edgar Hoover, made a personal mission to try to get Einstein on for being pro-communist. It was said that his house in Berlin in the 1920s was the home for communist meetings and so on, which is nonsense. And a lot of other comparable things. There's a file about 1,800 pages thick the FBI compiled, trying to find some element of actionable subversion, you know, that they could get him on. In practice, they found nothing that they could manage to bring out. Of course, he had left-wing views. And he made some public statements, which he got a lot of hate mail from and so on. But his position and his credibility internationally and nationally was such that it was very hard to get the kind of evidence which would stick. And I think this is one area which is rather important, that his scientific genius made him almost invulnerable. he had a great friendship with Paul Robeson, who was really hounded by the FBI, had his passport withdrawn and so on. Of course, Paul Robeson, a black activist as well as a wonderful singer. And yet Einstein was able, as it were, to ride out these subversive contacts, I think, in part because of his celebrity and his status, and that stayed with him throughout his time in America, which was about 20 years in America, 23 years.
One of the last things I want to bring up is his observations on the on American society and whether and how he viewed the racial issues. Now that you put up, you know, brought up Paul Robeson, and how did that in any way relate to his views on cultural Zionism? Did he see any correlation there between an ethnic identity as a Jew and a black identity?
Undoubtedly, yes. I think it gave him an insight into racial discrimination, and also and being an outsider, I think, and somebody of plain of fairly blunt views. But yes, it sensitized him, I think, to the racial issue. And it's interesting that in one of his most prominent essays on this, which is quite early in the mid 30s, he talked about the racial issue as being the issue in America. This is the middle of the Depression. You know, most people are thinking, hey, you know, the Depression is the thing. But he thought, as I said in those days, the Negro question was the big issue for America. And that was unusual and also regarded as being subversive. It wasn't just high theory. He developed personal friendships. When Marian Anderson, the opera singer, came to Princeton to sing, she couldn't find a hotel. He put her up. And every time she came to Princeton after that, she was born in Princeton. Paul Robeson was born in Princeton. He put her up in his own house. He talked to local people in Princeton, New Jersey, local African Americans in the street, and is still remembered by young children who were children then and now grown up. He had a very natural way of talking to people, and I'm sure it's partly because of his partly temperament, partly because of his identification with a minority, which was used to being ethnically singled out and discriminated against.
Okay, I have a final question for you, which is, what is Einstein's legacy, and what is his long-term influence, do you believe?
Well,
besides science, the obvious, which is science.
The obvious thing is science. I suppose my view is that it is on an ethical take on international politics. That is, an ethical take which is not simply a laying down of a moral law and saying you must abide by this, but a willingness to engage at every point with the ethical questions. And this is why I say that the last line of my book is that he's testimony to the fact that politics, there's much more involved in politics than politics. And he represents that something else. And, of course, there is a danger here. You know, it's very easy to make moral judgments about things that happen in politics. Politics is a complex issue. Not all issues are black and white. Or very few issues are black and white, I should say. I think what is unique about him is his ability to take a moral stance which wasn't a preachy stance, which wasn't a sort of somebody standing on the sidelines sniping away. It was somebody who engaged, who gave himself to these issues in a way that is quite rare. And I think if you read his writings, listen to him speak, you'll get a sense of somebody who is who is engaged actively. And actually, I'm seeing it even more clearly now as I think about it than I did when I wrote the book. And that's what comes over to me is an individual who gave himself to these issues, not just his mind.
Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. You can reach me through my website at lillianbarger.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.